Hello, and welcome to Conversations with the Legal Academy, a podcast from the University of Arkansas School of Law. My name is Brian Galini.
And I'm Colin Hesse. In this episode, Jeffrey Rosen, President and CEO of the National Constitution Center and a law professor at George Washington University, talks with Senior Associate Dean Galini about his research. He was on campus to discuss the future of privacy and free speech in the age of Google and Facebook as part of the Hartman Hotz Lectures in Law and Liberal Arts.
We hope you enjoy the conversation.
Well, I'm here with Jeff Rosen, excited to finally have the opportunity to sit down and visit with you. And let's start, I guess, first by perhaps you could talk a little bit about what you're doing in Arkansas and what you're doing on campus and why we're lucky enough to have you join us here at the law school.
Well, I'm really excited to be here, and I'm here to talk about the future of privacy and free speech in a digital age. It's hard to imagine a more exciting and important topic, and there's so much to think about. Every day there's a new controversy in the news that challenges us to try to rethink those boundaries. The Supreme Court is about to hear a really important cell phone privacy case that could determine the future of digital privacy, and that combined with the controversies about hate speech on campus and online makes the topic unusually interesting.
I think that's right. As you were talking, I was thinking about, 15 to 20 questions all popped in my head right away. One of which is, it is such a broad-ranging topic. I wonder if, sort of gun to head, you had to pick one area that you think is particularly intriguing, particularly hot. And you talked a little bit about cell phones, but then that sort of danced into campus and free speech there. Is there something that there's a digital privacy topic that just rises to the top of the list in your opinion?
Well, I'm going to start with the cell phone case because it really is so central. And the question there is, can the police subpoena your cell phone records and reconstruct all of your movements in public for 5 months, for 127 days? So what the court says about that question will determine, for example, whether in the not-so-distant future, the government could fly tiny drones in the air that could surveil us, could fix on any one of us and track our movements door to door and then publish them on the internet. Do you need a warrant for that? Do you have to have some kind of individualized suspicion? If the police can do that without individualized suspicion, then we really could have no privacy in public places.
Well, it seems to me that's exactly what Smith v. Maryland suggests, right? It's particularly why I'm excited the court is considering this, although I take it there's a danger, and I wonder if you worry about this, that there's a danger that the court will say, yeah, we talked about this in Smith v. Maryland. What are we all doing here? Do you think that's possible, or do you think, as I'm sort of hoping, that we'll update that line of thinking because so much has changed since then?
So Smith v. Maryland, as you know, of course, said in the 1970s that when I turn over records to a bank, the bank can turn over those records to the government because I have no expectation of privacy in records or data that I turn over to third parties. And that's known as the third party doctrine. And exactly as you suggest, if taken literally, that would mean that when I walk down the street and voluntarily turn over my geolocational records to my cell phone provider, which stores it in the digital cloud, then I have no expectation that those records won't be turned over to others. I am not only hopeful but optimistic that the court will not apply Smith v. Maryland to this situation. I had an amazing experience recently. I was giving a talk on this topic at Chautauqua, which is the great 19th century founded Institute of Learning up in upstate New York, talking about the case and talking about Smith v. Maryland. And suddenly this guy, there were about 1,000 people in the audience, this guy raises his hand in the front row and says, I argued Smith v. Maryland. This is the guy,
wow,
the lawyer in the case. It was completely synchronistic. And he said, I don't think it should apply in this case, although I think it was correctly decided because I argued on behalf of the government. I believe, this gentleman said, that the amount of information that can be reconstructed by geolocational surveillance is so much greater than what can be reconstructed by the single deep dive into a series of bank records, that we do have an expectation of privacy in the whole of our movements for a month. And that's exactly what the court unanimously held for different reasons in the Jones case, which involved GPS surveillance. It's what the court unanimously held in the Riley case, which said that when you arrest someone, you can't open their cell phones without individualized suspicion. So I think all of the justices understand that in an age when we live on our cell phones, to say that we have no expectation of privacy in those digital records would mean, as Justice Sonia Sotomayor said in the Jones case, that we have no privacy today.
Yeah, and a powerful opinion she wrote in that case. I wonder if, speaking of Jones, what cuts against it, and I'm fighting my urge to, I'm channeling my devil's advocate despite my desire to do so, is the physical trespass component of all of this, right? When we think about third-party doctrine stuff, we don't necessarily have that one-to-one relationship where the beeper is installed on the car, as in Jones, or it's my cell phone, as in Riley. How do you think we work around that?
It's a great question. In Jones, five justices, led by Justice Scalia, emphasized the fact that there was physical trespass when the police walked onto the guy's driveway and physically affixed the GPS device on the bottom of his car. But four justices, led by Justice Alito, said it makes no sense to focus on physical trespass because the police could have gotten the same information by subpoenaing the guy's cell phones as is at issue in this Carpenter case. I count at least five votes on behalf of the Alito position because Justice Sotomayor, although she formally joined Justice Scalia's opinion, took a much broader position and said we must rethink this entire doctrine for a digital age. So that's at least five, and we don't know what Justice Gorsuch thinks. And we also have I don't have any reason to think that, for example, Chief Justice Roberts, who was with Justice Scalia in the Jones case, but nevertheless held in the Riley case that we have an expectation of privacy in our cell phones, wouldn't also rise to the occasion. So it's hard to predict how broad or how narrow the court will go. And of course, Chief Justice Roberts likes to try to persuade his colleagues to converge around narrow, unanimous opinions. So maybe it'll be decided relatively narrowly. But I am expecting, although predictions are dangerous, a broad bipartisan, something more than a 5-4 decision on behalf of digital privacy.
So the $10 million question from my perspective then is, you're the Chief Justice, you assign the opinion to yourself. What does the rationale look like? Because I'm concerned maybe is too strong of a word, but I guess I'm still having trouble, the thinking in Riley, I've got it, right? I have an expectation of my cell phone because it's my phone. When I think about subpoenaing records, or I think about my location over a period of months, a lot of that may happen on public thoroughfares, right? And trust me, I get it. There's a difference between me walking there and then the government watching me walk there. I respect that. But how do you reconcile that technically the court has this tradition of, hey, you're in public over here, your apps, your contacts, your texts, well, they're not public over here.
Well, Justice Alito nailed it in his separate opinion, where he says, in a world where public surveillance with or without trespass can reveal so much about us, we do have an expectation of privacy in the whole of our movements. But it's true that the court has not squarely confronted the question of warrantless surveillance without physical trespass. In some ways, since the Olmstead case involving physical wiretapping. Mm-hmm. And the model then for how to resolve this case is not the majority opinion by Chief Justice Taft, which just said no trespass, no violation, but the prophetic, inspiring, completely transformative dissenting opinion by my hero, Justice Louis Brandeis, who said that the progress of espionage is not likely to stop with wiretapping. And in this amazing prophetic passage, he has in his desk drawer a clipping about this new technology, television, but he misunderstands it. He thinks it's a two-way technology where people can see each other through both ends of the camera. So he anticipates Skype and basically the cloud. And he alludes to it, and he says, ways may someday be developed by which it's possible without physically intruding into the home to extract secret papers and introduce them in court. Advances in the psychic and related sciences may make it possible to reveal unexpressed thoughts, sensations, and emotions. For Brandeis, the question is the amount of information being revealed threatening our ability to control our thoughts, sensations, and emotions even more dramatically than the general warrants that sparked the American Revolution? And he said wiretapping obviously does, because it invades the privacy of people on both ends of the wires. This is a quantum leap forward in terms of the amount of information that can be revealed. So the Brandeisian solution in this case would just say, when you have surveillance of our movements in public, which can reveal amounts of intimate information that make the general warrants look like puny instruments of tyranny, then not only is it impermissible without a warrant, It might even be impermissible with a warrant, which is what Brandeis said in Olmsted, that when you're just invading a huge amount of intellectual privacy, it's got to be a really serious crime and a really good reason, or else it's not justified.
So I assume that even on that approach, you know, and I'm thinking about things like here in Arkansas recently, we had a prospective homicide where one of the issues was whether the Alexa, Amazon technology had recorded any type of conversation prior to or after the alleged homicide. And so whether Amazon needed to turn over, pursuant to state subpoena, information related to Alexa's data was at issue. And I'm wondering if we flip it, rather than the government saying you must turn it over, I assume there's still the lingering problem of, as a matter of corporate policy, what if Amazon just said we cooperate with authorities and that's just how we do things?
No question that this is an age when Amazon and Google and Facebook have more power over privacy and free speech than any government or Supreme Court justice. And that's going to be my second point in the talk, is what to do about free speech in such an age. So that makes the privacy policies and the hate speech policies of the platforms more significant in some ways than First Amendment jurisprudence.
Yeah. Well, and thinking also about the way that a corporate, you know, the way that a corporate stance works on this platform, to your point, is powerful. You look at Apple saying, no, we're not, or Apple or Google saying, no, we're not going to comply with subpoenas. We're not going to assist, for example, in cracking an iPhone. And I wonder how that messaging works to the consumer, right? Because I think talking about policy is one thing, but then messaging it the right way to the individual feels like another thing. And I wonder if you've thought about, okay, even if they have the right policy, what's to prevent the user from saying, well, I just checked the end user agreement, and no matter what they say, right, I've agreed to it.
Have you ever read a privacy policy?
No.
And I'm supposed to be we both teach criminal procedure. We're both supposed to know something about privacy. Neither of us, like any other decent American, has ever read a privacy policy.
Right.
And there's something about the notion that there are certain kinds of privacy rights that we shouldn't be coerced or encouraged to alienate, even by consent. We live on these platforms. To say we could choose voluntarily to avoid them is not really practical.
Sure.
And Justice Harlan, in his concurring opinion in the Smith case, said, the White case, said, the question is how much privacy are people entitled to expect in a decent society. It was not an expectation of privacy test. It wasn't subjective. It wasn't based on consent. It was a normative standard that there's a certain amount of immunity from surveillance that is necessary for individuality and freedom and autonomy. Now, that's a hard standard to enforce for judges. It's a little abstract. It's a kind of natural law-based approach. I'm not counting on the Supreme Court to hold that, and I'm also not convinced that the platforms should be required to abide by it, certainly not by the Constitution, which doesn't formally bind them, and Congress and state legislatures show little inclination to impose that kind of regulation legislatively. But just as a matter of what the right answer is, I think the answer can't be if you sign it away on a privacy policy, it's okay.
I think that's right. I guess my last question, maybe in this line of conversation, is I wonder if some of this also would cause us to rethink our approach to, so not just third party doctrine, but also this norm that whatever we voluntarily disclose to law enforcement, we have no privacy interest. And I'm thinking about cases like Greenwood, the trash case, where we've all been, who teach in this area, and students are normalized to say, okay, as soon as I turn my trash over, law enforcement could sniff through it. But I've always been concerned that there's a difference between my trash guy picking it up and a police officer waiting to go through my trash. And I wonder if there's something there that some of what we're talking about even reaches in to forcing us to rethink some of that norm as well.
Yes, Greenwood is such an interesting case. And when I teach it, people kind of disagree. And it sort of almost depends on what kind of house you live in. You know, in an apartment, you just put it down the chute. And if you're in a house and put it out on the street, you kind of expect people might go through it. But the digital data is not trash. It's our most intimate and meaningful and precious and valuable expressions of intellectual creativity. So to treat data like trash seems wrong. So yeah. Therefore, the analogy must not be right. It's obvious. It just doesn't intuitively
doesn't
resonate.
Track. It doesn't. Yeah. Track. Yeah. Well, let's I guess shift more into you, and I wonder if you could talk a little bit about, all the way back at the beginning, what got you initially interested in digital privacy and more generally constitutional issues.
I went to law school, like many people, because I didn't know what else to do. I loved writing and history and government. I was an English and government major in college, and I loved to write and to read, but didn't quite know how to, you know, what to do. So I went to law school, and in law school, I just became incredibly passionate about the Constitution. Most of my classes were taught like common law classes, so I know very little practical law. And whenever anyone has any practical legal question, I have lots of good lawyers to refer them to, but I'm not one of them. But I really love the Constitution. And also in law school, I decided I wanted to be a journalist. I knew that I wouldn't be a good real lawyer and wouldn't enjoy it. And I just started writing for the college newspaper for the first time in law school, and then got this incredible internship at the New Republic magazine. And it was the most exciting thing I'd ever done, and it was writing about the Supreme Court and about the justices. So I decided I would not be a lawyer and would be a journalist. And my mom almost jumped off a building because it was a very expensive legal education that she helped to support. But through just an amazing synchronistic stroke of luck, as well as the fact that I'd gone to college with the editor of the New Republic, which makes me the Harriet Myers of legal journalism. He, Andrew Sullivan, was the editor at the time, and he just called out of the blue and said, come back and be our legal affairs editor. So just out of law school, after clerking for a year, I got this incredible break, an opportunity to write about the law and the Supreme Court at a time when there's no internet. There aren't a lot of other venues to really write about it seriously, and it was an astonishing platform and a thrilling experience for which I'm be grateful for the rest of my life. So I did that for a while, and then I decided to return to my love for the Constitution and to go into law teaching, both because I loved it and also because law teaching is a much more stable basis for writing than journalism was, so tenure is a fine thing. And was very happy as a teacher and writer for more than two decades. And in the course of that, I just wrote about the topics in the news and then tried to dig into them deeply and understand them. And I got into privacy through the Clinton impeachment. I'd been writing a series of articles for magazines about how it was that the independent counsel was able to subpoena Monica Lewinsky's bookstore receipts. That seemed like such a so jarring, given the fact that the privacy of private diaries was the core Fourth Amendment violation that inflamed the colonists when they were worried about the anonymous papers of John Wilkes, the critic of King George. So that just sent me down all sorts of wonderful, not rabbit holes, but just exciting areas of exploration. I wrote a bunch of popular articles and then wrote my first book about privacy, trying to explain how the law had evolved in a way that made the Clinton impeachment possible. That book came out in 2000, just as the internet was exploding. So it was really an exciting time to be thinking about privacy. And suddenly, the indignity that Monica Lewinsky had experienced by having her bookstore receipts subpoenaed was one that every citizen could identify with in an age when our electronic records and emails and increasingly browsing habits could be revealed to the world. And then came Google and Facebook, and suddenly the problem of Monica Lewinsky was the problem of all of us, and this danger of being judged out of context on the basis of snippets of information rather than genuine knowledge is something that we all live with daily. So that's how I got into that subject, and it's just been evolving and changing, but it seems to be more meaningful and relevant every day.
And as your career has evolved from professor now to sort of a different platform, how did that happen? And how did we go from D.C. now to Philadelphia and into the center?
Another act of great serendipity or synchronicity or luck or whatever you want to call it, I was really happy as a journalist and law professor having, I think, you know, two of the greatest jobs in the world. And out of the blue, the National Constitution Center in Philadelphia called when they were looking for a new head. And I initially wasn't interested because I loved my jobs, but then I understood what the Constitution Center is, which is, as I love to recite from the Congressional Charter, the only institution in America created by the U.S. Congress during the bicentennial of the Constitution to engage in nonpartisan constitutional education and debate. And as it happens, one of my great passions is to bring together people of different perspectives, liberals and conservatives, to debate not political issues but constitutional issues. I don't know where it came from exactly. Even in college, I felt like I had some sort of mission to bring people of different perspectives together. And then I, at the Aspen Institute, moderated seminars that engaged in this and just really resonated with the mission. And this is what the Constitution Center was looking for. And it was just the greatest break of my life, because it's the most meaningful work. I just am really passionate and grateful to be able to work on behalf of a mission that's much larger than I am, that's crucially, urgently important in these polarized times when people are living in filter bubbles and echo chambers and are not listening to each other and talking to each other, and the need actually to educate citizens of all ages from 8 to 80 about the Constitution, to present the text, to allow people to dig into the historical cases and hear the best arguments on both sides and make up their minds. It seems to me not only a civic duty, but it's the only way to escape from the unproductive political warfare that is paralyzing the country. So it's incredibly satisfying, meaningful, and important work. The Constitution Center is an amazing place. It's both a museum of the Constitution. It's this gorgeous I.M. Pei building on Independence Mall in Philadelphia, across from Independence Hall, as you know from your Philly days. I think it had just opened around the time you left. And it has rare copies of the Constitution, the very earliest drafts of the Constitution written by James Wilson, one of the 12 original copies of the Bill of Rights, an inspiring patriotic show with a live actor that tells the story of America, a new gallery we're building about the constitutional legacy of the Civil War and Reconstruction. So it's thrilling to see hundreds and on big days thousands of school kids just learning about the Constitution through physical exhibits. But in addition to that, it has this mandate to be America's only nonpartisan platform for constitutional education and debate. So the centerpiece of what we are doing there is this thrilling interactive Constitution, which I'm going to plug tonight, and I'm going to plug right now because I do it all the time because it's my mission. So I want listeners to go to the App Store and find Interactive Constitution, or the web at constitutioncenter.org, and I'll show it to you here. But it is the coolest thing. It's gotten 11 million hits since it launched a year ago, and it's co-sponsored by the Federalist Society and the American Constitution Society, the leading liberal and conservative lawyers organizations in America. And it is, you can just click on any clause of the Constitution, and we'll pick a nice uncontroversial one like the Second Amendment. And there you find the leading liberal and conservative scholars of the Second Amendment, nominated by FedSoc and ACS, Nelson Lund and Adam Winkler, beginning with a 1,000-word common statement about what they agree the Second Amendment means, and then separate 1,000-word statements about what they disagree about. And multiply that by all 80 clauses of the Constitution, from the Fourth Amendment to the Export and Import Preference Clause to the Foreign Emoluments and Pardons Clause, pick whatever you like, you'll find how, first of all, educational it is to find the liberal and conservative scholars agreeing about the core meaning of the text. It turns out there's much more agreement than the Supreme Court's divisiveness suggests, and all of the scholars, almost all of whom said yes, were pretty quickly able to converge on their common statements, and then you can look at the areas of disagreement. It's a roving constitutional education, and it's thrilling. The College Board has adopted it as the centerpiece of the new AP History and Government exams, and our mission is to bring it to every American. We're creating lessons plans, videos with Khan Academy, teacher training workshops, and I teach this stuff as you do, and I learn every time I click onto it, because I don't know about most of these clauses. I've just studied a few of them, and there's a whole lot to learn. And we all have an obligation to learn, not just law professors, but citizens. And the Constitution is not just for lawyers or law professors. It is for all citizens. And Jefferson said democracy can't survive ignorant and free, and he was right. So we need to educate ourselves. The final thing we're doing, I feel like a Ginsu knife salesman, but that's not a salesman. That's not all. In addition to this great, the museum, and there's this educational work, we do debates in all formats. We have a podcast series where every week I call up a top liberal and conservative scholar, and just we talk about the constitutional issue of the week. So just last week we did the president's war powers, and tomorrow we're going to record the legal issues arising out of Charlottesville, and we'll do a special on the pardon power. And it's very educational for me, because I don't know about these topics until I've dug into them, to get the experts and just ask them basic questions, and sometimes they agree and sometimes they disagree, and they're wonky but wonderful, and they have about 100,000 listeners a month. And people are really hungry for constitutional education. And then finally, we travel around the country and do these debates, sometimes with FedSoc and ACS, and sometimes with other partners like Intelligence Squared, and pick a topic like Resolve, does the First Amendment protect hate speech, or we do, should you, the police be able to seize your cell phone records, as in the Carpenter case, and we have those debates and record them and broadcast them. So that's what the Constitution Center is, and it's just, I feel really lucky to be doing it, and it feels like very meaningful work, and we are trying to inspire people to educate themselves and converge in these polarized times around this incredible document of human freedom that unites us, which is the Constitution.
You've picked, to be diplomatic about it, an interesting time to engage in the work. Have you found it, in trying to execute your mission, difficult to remain objective across the platforms that you deliver the messages?
It is important to be nonpartisan. We must be nonpartisan. That is our mission. And these are very partisan times, so it is a challenge. But the way that we negotiate it is to say we will never talk about political issues. We'll only talk about constitutional issues. As a fellow law professor, you understand that distinction, but it's not intuitive to most citizens. So you have to explain the distinction. We're not going to talk about, is the travel ban a good idea? The question is, does the Constitution allow or prohibit it? And then you encourage people. Entertain the possibility that you might reach a constitutional conclusion that clashes with your political views. You might think the travel ban is a great idea, but the Constitution forbids it, or it's a terrible idea, but the Constitution allows it. And that just frees us up to discuss anything.
That's great.
We're not going to make a judgment about whether the president is good or bad, or whether his policies are good or bad. The question is, are they consistent with the Constitution? And there tend to be pretty good arguments on both sides of most of these questions, because most contested constitutional questions are open and hard. Not all. I think, you know, some of the free speech questions and the digital privacy questions we talked about, you could get bipartisan majorities, but many other questions have good arguments on all sides. So that's the way we negotiate it.
When you think about that term educate, you know, you talked about it's rewarding to see school groups come in and to learn from sort of the early years all the way up through leading scholars debating the issues. Do you have in your own mind, do you have a target audience? You know, we want to reach everyone, reach the masses, but within that sphere, we're really hoping to access X or Y.
I just want to reach lifelong learners and inspire them to learn about the Constitution. It's so meaningful when, I mean, sometimes people will, podcast listeners, as you know, are real junkies. And I've had people come up on the street and say, "Are you Jeff? I don't know your voice or something." But you know, at 40.3 in the last podcast, this scholar said that people are really listening closely, and that's really meaningful. So I think that there are lifelong learners of all ages and all backgrounds all around the country, and if you build it, they will come. If you present rigorous, balanced material, people who love learning will find it.
I wonder if you could talk a little bit to sort of the prospective student portion of our audience and your thoughts on kind of where law school is now, just globally speaking, open-ended question, and then maybe what advice you have for students thinking through their decision to go to law school.
Well, law school as I hope you can tell from my excitement in talking about these issues, is the most wonderful intellectual opportunity imaginable to stretch your mind, to deepen yourself as a citizen, to engage in the most intellectually rigorous arguments with bright fellow students and professors. It's just a magnificent intellectual experience if you approach it in the right spirit. But it's a tough and important decision about whether or not to go to law school now. It's really expensive. The debt can be really large. The legal market is not anything like what it was when I was going to law school. And that decision I made a long time ago to go to law school because I didn't know what else I was going to do and I didn't really want to be a lawyer and I thought it would be great general education is a luxury that not everyone has today because it's just too hard to pay off the debt. So I would think very hard about going to law school, not because it's not fascinating, but just because the financial burden is so big. And also there's the question of what happens next. And here is what I want to say. The decision not to be a lawyer was the toughest, hardest, and most important of my life. I was trained just to do what everyone else did and to try to go to good schools and get good grades and just go along. And to get off the treadmill, to use the words of the dean of our law school who used to say you're off the treadmill now, required taking a risk, which I really hadn't been trained to do. And it paid off very dramatically because I had these wonderful opportunities that never would have come about if I hadn't taken a risk and if I'd just gone to a law firm. But all of the pressures of law school encourage people to do what everyone else is doing, to go to the best firms they can go to make as much money as they can. And although that's great for some people, and if you love being a lawyer, and there are many people who do, it's a wonderful profession, which you can do well and do good and be satisfied. But not everyone loves being a lawyer. I knew that I wouldn't have loved it. And if you go to a law firm but don't love it, you're not going to do well. You'll be miserable. It's in the end, you're not going to thrive. And it's just not a happy situation. So I really want to stress the seriousness of the decision of what to do after law school. The decision to go is not hard because you go and it's interesting and you learn all this cool stuff. But what you do after is hugely important. And I really don't, I always tell friends and students, don't just go to a firm for a couple of years because you think it'll be fine and I'll pay off my debts and I'll figure out what to do. That just, they can be a kind, can be a kind of golden handcuffs. Mm-hmm. You get used to a certain lifestyle and all, and you do, and you close off other options. So at my law school commencement, a teacher gave a talk, and his basic message was do what you like, not what everyone else is doing and not what your parents think you should like, but do what you, follow your bliss or your passion, which is now a commonplace for people of all ages. The problem is, as he noted, that it's hard to figure out what you like.
Yeah.
Not everyone knows it, or if you don't have a calling or don't have an opportunity that allows you to carve out your own path and do stuff that other people aren't doing, it can be difficult, and can also, to the degree that it requires taking a risk, can be really scary.
Probably one of my last questions, but how do you, you know, there's some good literature out there that suggests that law students are, whether they're predisposed and self-select or in law school, they mature into somewhat risk-averse personalities. I think you've really hit something there. To what extent can the school, can a law school or can the culture of the law help push back against that? Is there a nugget of advice? Is there something we're doing wrong in the education? Or is it inevitable?
I think schools should try to send the message that we're discussing. It's a great thing when schools are financially stable enough to provide loan forgiveness programs that are generous and are available not only for people who, you know, go into certain kinds of public interest law narrowly defined, but take any low-paying job. That was what I was able to be on loan forgiveness for a couple of years working as legal editor of the New Republic because I was at the poverty rate at the Y. And it was wonderful that my law school didn't care that I was a journalist, but just supported that. That requires financial resources, but that's really welcome. And then just having teachers and administrators talk really candidly, just honestly about about these choices. These are really the most important choices in people's lives, and not to pretend that as long as you get into the best firm you can, you're gonna be happy. Simply because that keeps up the statistics for the school's U.S. news ratings and stuff like that is a blessing. So I'm not, I believe my mission in life, my passion is to be a law teacher. I think it's the most meaningful thing imaginable. So I obviously I really love teaching law, and I think law school is a great and noble thing to do. But we just have to approach it with open eyes and candor, and people have to be honest and rigorous with themselves about what makes them happy and willing to take risks.
Well, thank you so much for your time and for coming to visit us. I really enjoyed our conversation.
Me too. Thanks for the really great questions.
Of course.
For more information on Conversations with the Legal Academy, show notes, and additional episodes, go to law.uark.edu/podcast. Or you can find us at kuaf.com under the local and podcast menu. You can also listen to episodes or subscribe through iTunes or with your favorite podcast app. If you enjoy the show, please give us a review on Apple Podcasts, which will help others find us. Music for Conversations with the Legal Academy was written and performed by Josh Woodward. To keep up with us between episodes, follow the University of Arkansas School of Law on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter by searching for UARK Law. That's UARKLAW. Thank you for listening.